Welcome back to the Media Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo.
And J.R. Peters.
Yo, yo, yo.
Here at the Media Movie Club, we select three movies. We review them at our website, mediacommovie.club. And after we reviewed each of those movies one a week, we get together at the end of the month to discuss them on a podcast. And this last month, we watched in honor of Ennio Morricone, the famed composer who has composed many classic film scores. We watched Once Upon a Time in the West, The Thing, and The Untouchables. We're going to kick it off with Once Upon a Time in the West. Shane did not watch this movie.
Nope.
It is. It's 3 hours long.
I basically took half a week off of work. Still didn't watch it. But I was also on pain medicine, so focusing for 3 hours?
Fair enough. This is Sergio Leone's last film, and he only made 6 films. I was surprised to find out about that in my research. He only made 6 films, and this is his last one in the American West. He followed this up with a movie in Mexico, and followed that up with his final film, Once Upon a Time in America. But Once Upon a Time in the West comes after he finished the Dollars trilogy.
Is Once Upon a Time in America the one with the mouse?
That's not Fievel Goes West. That's
Fievel Goes West.
Fievel's Tale, An American Tale, is that what it's called?
Fievel
in America.
Fievel Goes West.
Yes. Sergio Leone directed Fievel Goes West.
I think he voiced Fievel, actually.
Okay. Wow.
And he didn't change his voice or anything. That's what he sounded like.
That's amazing.
It really is. I'm glad that he could found his true calling as a as a mouse escaping Russian pogroms. But before his voiceover career really took off, he directed the Dollars trilogy starring Clint Eastwood, Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, Good, Bad, Ugly, one of the first Munich Movie Club movies. And he followed that up with Once Upon a Time in the West. This is an original story where those other three are adaptations of Akira Kurosawa movies. Not so much Good, Bad, and the Ugly, but certainly the first two. And this is part of a trend of, not really a trend, but it's something that repeatedly happens where like a foreign director comes to America, makes a movie about America, and has as clear, if not clearer, a picture of the country than people who've lived here and marinated in American history and American culture and American education their entire life.
Listen, I followed Dinesh D'Souza on Twitter, and I refuse to believe that Americans don't understand history in that context.
I mean, he's made a lot of great movies, predicting the future. And, I mean, he's 3 for 3 so far.
That's right.
This being one example of that, a foreign director coming in and just really explaining exactly what America is. Andrew Dominik from Australia being another with Assassination of Jesse James. Maybe that's just me. I don't know. One of my favorite movies. And then you've got someone like Steve McQueen making a movie about slavery with 12 Years a Slave. They're just coming at it without any, like, romantic ideas, perhaps, about America. And Once Upon a Time in the West is a rough and clear-eyed vision of what is very often a romantic setting. Romantic, like capital R romantic. Like, JR, what'd you think of Once Upon a Time in the West?
I thought it was great. I didn't know anything about the movie, so giving me the Henry Fonda as the bad guy reveal was great. Just, I'm sure, you know, at the time that probably caused a couple heart attacks by some people, but I thought it was a really good thing. But also just in general, I really enjoyed the film. Probably an A-. I don't know what I said in the group, but I'll probably say A-, B+, something like that. But we'll talk about it later. But one of the things it does that I love so much is just like overly long scenes. I don't know why.
I mean, yeah, we'll talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why I love it, but I do.
I'm right there with you. This is my second time watching it, and I was better equipped, I think, in this later viewing to really settle into those, as you said, very long scenes. I was able to, there were a few too many for me. I was getting a little tired of them by the 6th or 7th or 8th. Very long stare off between characters, but I was able to at least like thematically justify why these characters are staring off against each other. This movie's got a pretty famous opening scene that is essentially just that. There's not a lot of dialogue. It's a train station in the middle of nowhere, and there's three goons, a ticket taker, and the character who will only really be known as Harmonica, and just a lot of staring, a lot of harmonica playing, a lot of contemplation of what you're going to do next. And like in this viewing, what really struck home for me about that and other future scenes like that is that these people are making like life and death decisions. What am I going to do about these three? If I'm a lone ticket taker in an isolated train station and three guys come in looking to purchase a ticket, I think that's what they're there for, but I don't really know. Am I going to die right now? Are they going to abide by rules of like gentle commerce that they don't have to abide by? No one's really making them do it right now. And while that guy is staring at them, he's thinking about that. And while the goons are staring at the ticket taker, they're like, should we just murder this guy or should we stuff him in the closet? Should we be gentle with this guy? Who's really making us do that? Maybe I had a shitty cup of coffee this morning and I would like to kill somebody. And there are truly no consequences to that right now. And that just like base nature of America, of this American idea about like, well, we can always just trade goods and services at least. Well, who really said? That all comes after these places get settled. And so much of Once Upon a Time in the West is how these places get settled in the first place.
If you want to watch a really good show about kind of like settling and civilization, building a civilization, I do recommend Deadwood.
No, that's, yeah.
I've seen that one.
I thought you were going to say like The Wonder Years or something like that. But you really surprised me with Deadwood. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know you liked that show. I'm going to have to check it out.
It's like a Shakespearean Western.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Fascinating. We would strongly recommend that people dig deep into our archives and find all of our Deadwood episodes.
I have heard of this show.
Yeah, I'm glad I could add
Is it on Stars? Is that where I should go to?
it's
on Quibi, actually. 10-minute chunks. Is that what Quibi is? I truly have no idea.
10 minutes of a Village Out monologue.
It just cuts off halfway through. It's longer than 10 minutes. Yeah, so much of Deadwood is encapsulated in Once Upon a Time in the West. Just these people that think that the rules of society are going to continue to apply to this new place. And even if they don't, at least I'll be able to remake the world as I see fit. I might have been a lowly prostitute, factory worker, immigrant, whatever. But out here, I'm a landowner, I'm a farmer, I can make plans and have deeds stamped for my future. Until someone more powerful than you has the exact same idea and squashes you. Because just as you can remake the world out in the West that has been, you know, wiped clean of the people that live there long before you showed up, you can also be wiped clean yourself. It's not manifest destiny as much as it is pure might makes right. You're going to be killed because a rich guy wants to see the Pacific Ocean. Just brutally, brutally honest about the whole thing. Yeah, this is a really strong, really great movie from Sergio Leone. Have you, JR or Shane, I suppose, well, yeah, you've seen Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
I've seen the Dollars Trilogy.
You've seen all the Dollars Trilogy. Okay.
I have not seen any of them.
Okay.
This was really like my first Western that I've seen. But really? We could just say that. Yeah.
Like mid-century Western.
Yes. Like, wow. I've seen True Grit, the remake, sure, the Coen Brothers one, but like I haven't seen any of these like original Clint Eastwood movie, you know, or any of that shit.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. Like, the spaghetti westerns exist often in their own area, and then there's like American westerns that, like John Wayne westerns, which are very much their own thing. I don't pretend to have like an encyclopedic knowledge of all those, because they were, if you ever seen Hail Caesar from the Coen brothers, like they were just churning these movies out as much as we churn out like $500,000 to $5 million budgeted horror movies. It was just, we filmed one, let's film five more before the year is over. And then some other studios doing a dozen more, and the Cowboys are singing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. They were the trash movies of their day. And within those restrictions, you can still find like really great stuff from people like Sergio Leone or John Ford or whoever. The Dollars Trilogy is very much like mythic. It's these people. It's this guy that's coming into a town, solving problems, and then he leaves. You don't really know that much about him by the end. And even The Good and Bad, The Ugly is also about these like mythic archetypes who are navigating the society, but or navigating the environment, but you don't really know that much about them. Whereas with Once Upon a Time in the West, it is getting away from it, fitting the same anti-romance milieu that it's applying to the West. The characters themselves are, you get a much better sense of what they want, where they come from, where they're going to go after, the ones that survive anyways. And it's more real characters as opposed to, like, as good as Clint Eastwood is in those Dollars trilogies, in those Dollars trilogy movies. I mean, they call him the man with no name. Like, he's got no past and no future. And there's a character like that here with Harmonica, but I still feel like you get a better sense of him than you do of Clint Eastwood in those movies. And I'm kind of talking to myself because JR saw Once Upon a Time in the West and you've seen the Dollars trilogy.
Yeah, so I know. Yeah. Pushback on The Good, Bad, and Ugly is really simple on the characters, because it was such, the point was to contrast the John Wayne Westerns were.
Sure. And I don't say that negatively. I like Good, the Bad, and Ugly better than this movie. Like, it's not my favorite Leone. I like that they're these, that they fit so neatly onto the title, each of the three main characters.
Although Blondie's hardly just straight up good. He just happens to
be nice. He's just pretty.
He does two good things and the fucking looks cool as shit.
Yeah. Yeah. speaking of Harmonica, I don't know where this was in Charles Bronson's career. I really only think of him as the character who would eventually be satirized on The Simpsons, the clerk who speaks in that particular accent from, and then also the Death Wish movies, which are, you know, a guy that murders criminals and gets away with it, and like a vigilante hero in New York in the bad 70s and 80s. So this version of him, where he's much younger and where he is the hero of the movie, pretty much, surprising, really surprising. Again, I don't know that much about his career, but just his face alone and the way that he is heavily tanned and the indeterminate lineage, I can't really tell what this guy's like family history is. Could be Native American, could be Mexican, who really knows? But just because he can be so many things, it lets the viewer like bring whatever baggage they want to this guy. Like, which trampled group of this individual has been trampled, which trampled group does he belong to? Doesn't really matter. He's just representative of this long lineage of the West being a place where good shit doesn't happen to people.
Speaking of lineage and like lawless territories, did you see that they figured out what happened to the Roanoke colony?
They just left.
It's
really not that much of a mystery. It's never fascinated me that much.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
but go ahead.
Pretty much they assimilated with...
It was Big Feet, wasn't it? It was a group of Big Feet that wiped them out.
Unfortunately, Europeans are poisonous, so when they ate them, they don't know.
That's where they went.
Yeah. No, they just assimilated with the Indian culture, and like they found a bunch of like European like styles of like digging. It's pretty, I don't know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes sense now. It would have been far more horrifying for people of that time to be like, oh, we can just melt into another person's culture as opposed to like just disappear out of thin air. I'd much prefer we could disappear out of thin air.
Yeah.
So, Harmonica.
Harmonica.
JR, any like thoughts about where that guy came from, and just how much the movie like loves this guy's face?
Yeah. I couldn't figure out what was going on with him either. I think the whole thing was, like you said, it's just supposed to be everyone represented.
Did you think it was a natural tan that he had, or did they like let him roast for a while?
Oh, no. They just, every day he would wake up, and just like Henry Fonda, they'd be like, sit down, they'd pull out a bag of dirt, and they'd just rub dirt on his face for like 30 minutes.
Yeah, that all seems like standard Western Western costuming and makeup to me. Like the Deadwood people. I've seen the behind the scenes extras on the DVD set. A proud owner, I am. And it's just people with like reverse vacuums blasting dust on people. So yeah, I assume there was a crowd of there was a gaggle of makeup people just painting these poor actors up. The length of some of these scenes, this is like a 2-hour 45-minute movie. I thought it was like a half an hour longer than it needed to be. I did kind of get the point after like an hour, after all the characters have been introduced. I'm pretty much with where the movie's going, and then it really stretches it out. JR, that was, if not an asset to you, then certainly not an annoyance. Like that just all worked. It was as long as it needed to be.
Yeah, it was not overly long to me. I would not have had a problem with it being shorter. Like I could see, but it wasn't any detriment to the movie for me. Yeah.
I feel like after they find the railroad baron, I'm really just waiting for the end. Like with Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, that movie really builds to the big standoff between the three main characters. Whereas this one, it builds to a standoff, but I feel like I had exhausted all of my interest by about the two-hour mark or so. So if that's the big knock against this, that's really the only knock against this movie for me. Like I'm at a B+, a little lower than your A range, but again, like occasionally those kind of long pauses and stares do work in the movie's favor. But yeah, it can get a little tiresome. Mark, since we selected this movie because of Ennio Morricone, scale of 1 to 5. How's this Morricone score stack up for you, JR?
I mean, like in general, I thought the score on this one was really good. Let's give it a 5. I really enjoyed it.
I get real close to that. I think this is one of his better ones. All the harmonica cues, whether they're actually harmonica playing his said instrument or if like it's on the soundtrack, every one of them worked for me. I love like. The Dollars Trilogy has all those too. These like very four note signature calls to this character or that character, and the same applies here. The way that a lot of times you'll hear the harmonica first, and then the score will start, and then it'll hit some kind of crescendo right as his as that really striking face is revealed, and I feel like this movie isn't as iconic as like everybody can imagine Clint Eastwood in the poncho, but this movie kind of just exists outside of that, so I don't feel like it exists in the culture as much. But there are moments in here accentuated by that score that stack up with anything that I think Leone ever did. So, Once Upon a Time in the West, available on Amazon Prime.
Yeah. Before we move on,
yeah,
I'd like to say, can you guys rank this against other West things? Let's go. How would you rank Once Upon a Time in the West versus Five Poor Goes West versus the song Bow Down by West Side Connection? And if you want, you can throw in former NBA player Delonte West. Go.
I know what two of those things are.
Well, since Delonte West.
The Bow Down, you come to our town.
Yeah.
Bow Down when you're westward bound.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. That's there you go.
That's how the song goes exactly, right? Yeah. In that cadence, in that tone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for not using the N-word.
Okay, so I know three of them.
Okay.
Delonte West is number one for banging LeBron's mom.
Oh, that is true.
God, is that a real thing?
I forgot.
Whoa. Are you telling me that Fievel and LeBron's mom never had a thing?
I did not. Not that.
Charming house.
Yeah. I forgot Delonte West. LeBron's mom.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And then everything else falls by the wayside. You got tied for second afterwards. Like nothing else matters.
So for JR, if Once Upon a Time in the West is an A-, banging LeBron James's mom is at least an A.
Banging LeBron's mom while you're his terrible teammate is an A+.
We're going to try something new this week. For the last couple months, Shane has needed a break from we never came up with a good name for that for that for the game you're playing. I mean, it was a good game. It was a strong game, but it required a lot of work.
And I forgot to do it every time.
And we have this ready-made resource at the Munich Movie Club, a giant spreadsheet of, at this moment, 3,915 movies that at least one of us have seen. So we thought, if we want to keep playing games, and we do.
We do.
Then why not use this resource a little bit? So I'm going to play the movie game. And I don't know. Someone out there has probably come up with a better, more descriptive name of this game. I don't know. We have not. The movie game is where you select a movie, and then someone names an actor from that movie, and then someone names a movie that actor is in, and so on and so on and so on. And when someone is stumped, they're out. So we're not going to play this game indefinitely, because I could, listeners. But just between each movie, we're going to play a little round of it, no more than 2 minutes. And I'm always going to go first because I'm okay at this game. Not to brag. Right. I'm a screener for the Atlanta Film Festival, and I'm okay at the movie game.
What are the qualifications to be a screener at the Atlanta Film Festival?
You have to have written something about a movie at one point. You have to have provided a writing sample to the screening committee.
And also, you had to pay $20 for a
membership.
Free membership.
I think it's available to anybody. I think JR, yes. JR, if you wanted to be a screener, I think you could be a screener. It's too late now. I'm ashamed to say, but I'm always going to go first just to level the playing field a little bit. So if I land on a very, so if we land on like a horror movie that someone put in here that I've never seen, like we're just to even the scales a little bit. But the first movie that we selected, thanks to the randomizer at random.org, is Rush Hour 2.
Okay.
So we're going to go for 2 minutes, and I'm going to say Chris Tucker. And we'll go Shane, JR. Chris Tucker.
Let's go. I'm just going to tee it up for JR. Friday.
Okay. And then what
and then you say actor from Friday.
I say another movie. Oh, I say an actor from Friday.
Yes.
Okay. So or I would say Ice Cube.
Inside of Friday.
Clock's ticking, yo.
Shit.
I said it. Ice Cube, yo.
Oh, Ice Cube. Okay. Boys in the Hood.
Cuba Gooding Jr.
Radio.
Ed Harris.
I'm trying to pick the most random, terrible ones.
You could have said Snow Dogs.
Right. Ed Harris.
I could have. Damn. is it Tilda Swinton? Is that her name?
Yeah.
Once we pass the 1 minute mark, I'm going to start upping my game a little bit. Okay. Sure. And I'm going to say Oakja.
Goddamn.
Paul Dano.
I'm out. I don't know. I have no fucking idea who that is.
JR is out.
No. Actually, I just read an article about him today. Little Miss Sunshine.
Okay. That's fine.
All right.
Abigail Breslin.
Don't know who that was in there. She was also the little girl in Runaway Train by Soul Asylum.
I don't think that's right.
Soul Asylum, but Black Dog. All
right, JR, Abigail Breslin?
I have no idea who that is. Is that the girl? Is that the little girl?
That is the little girl, yes.
At least I got that, yeah. What else was she in?
JR, nothing?
No, I have no idea.
All right, we went right to our minute, or our 2 minutes. She was also in Zombieland.
Hmm. No, yeah.
She was a girl in Zombieland.
That was much better, but there will be blood.
Yeah. Okay, so that's round one. I'm the winner. We'll see if the randomizer screws me on the next one. Yeah. Our next movie is The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982. Not the original, not the remake. The almost perfect horror movie from 1982. Body horror classic. And longtime members of the Munich Movie Club will know that I love me some body horror. I love me some popping sacks. I love me some weird oozes and fluids. Bring all that shit to the table. And boy, does The Thing bring that shit to the table.
You, your tattoo that says body horror classic is just on point.
And your preference this year. You can read it in multiple ways. this is a great movie. Pierce could not join us, but he gave this a resounding A+. Shane, what did you think of The Thing?
I'd like to rewatch it on a big screen, but I'm at an A- here, maybe A. I don't know.
I'm at an A- too. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, it's damn near perfect for what it is.
JR, The Thing.
I would have to agree with the very last statement that Shane said, that it's probably, it's perfect for what it is, even though it's, you know, it's probably an A, even though it's like absolutely my least favorite genre of movies, horror.
Yeah.
And then no, throw in body horror on top of
well,
it.
Well, I don't mind body horror, but horror movies is like the last.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't like horror at all. And then you're going to throw something, another qualifier on it. Like, you're just really like getting out of my range. That's all I'm saying.
Like, you wouldn't consider like the Saw movie body horror. That's just murder porn, right?
No, no.
I would say it's like adjacent to body horror. Like, it's torture porn first torture and foremost. Porn, yeah. Like, yeah, found in that genre. But just the
love
fact
me some torture porn.
That goes a long way.
Yeah.
I think there's like a jokey quality to body horror.
Yes.
And this, yeah, like when a head sprouts spider legs.
Awesome.
Something's going, like there's a joke there. David Cronenberg, like growths growing off of people and like human looking VCRs being fed human looking like flesh covered videotapes. Yeah, there's a goof there. This is a movie that was disrespected in its day. Critics hated it. Didn't make a lot of money. It cost John Carpenter, the legendary genre director who made movies like Escape from New York and Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween. That's another big one. Like, yeah, he found several genres, John Carpenter. But this cost him gigs, lost him work. But it has, as we are a testament, like it's been reevaluated later as like a classic cult. I wouldn't say canceled. That's a strong word. But
sorry, I only speak millennial. And,
yes, the PETA people really didn't like a giant gelatinous mass of dogs.
Next is how do we compare this to Harry Potter? Go. That's just fucking Twitter. Awful.
God, that's awful.
Experience of watching this. You guys both have never seen this before.
Never seen it. Watching it on my phone.
Yeah. Tell me about your goosebumps. Tell me about your jumps and your leaps and your shocks.
I didn't do any of those things.
Really?
Yeah. I was a little distracted, I think.
All right. So fair enough.
Watching on my phone at work. But I did have my headset in so I could actually hear it because it was nice. Nice show to listen to.
JR?
I didn't. I didn't do any of those either.
Okay.
I mean, I was straight up watching it, but like, I think you got to remember, possibly, I don't know, the maybe because the movie's old or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm sure if I would have watched it maybe when I was younger or in 1982 when it came out, you know, 10 years before I was born, that.
You mean like a lot of the moments had been like ruined for you and other things, or you catch like little snippets? Like the moment that I'm thinking of first and foremost is the chess mouth that really comes out of nowhere, or like the blood.
The chess mouth, I had seen the chess mouth, so like that got ruined for me.
Okay.
But like everything else, it wasn't like a jumpy movie or anything like that. I didn't feel like it was more just in the experience of the whole movie versus like a jump here and there, just like constant tension of you don't know who or what is the thing.
Yeah. This is my third time watching it, and we can talk about how much the cast stands out or doesn't, but I always forget who is infected and when, and I always forget when exactly the blood is going to jump out of the petri dish with the test that Kurt Russell's character devises.
Damn, you know what? That got me. I'll hop in. I jumped like a motherfucker when that blood hopped out. I completely forgot about that. That shit got me.
Yeah. There aren't really that many other scares. It's more you're just like marinating in this. And like the everything with the dogs is it's just escalation until you get this aforementioned massive dogs that are many dogs and one dog at the same time. Delightful.
That's exactly delightful. Like the three-headed dog in Harry Potter, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Fluffy.
Some interesting trivia about this movie. The special makeup effects designer Rob Bottin was 21 years old when he worked on the thing, and he was hospitalized for exhaustion during production because he took it so seriously. I think to great effect, because the creature effects in this, physical effects in this, like, who needs all this technology? Like, I don't care that it doesn't always look perfect. It looks, when it's working, it's working better than all your ones and all your zeros.
Well, it just feels so tangible on something like this compared to, you know...
it's happening in the room.
Robert Downey Jr.'s head floating through an entire green screen.
Yes, you know? It's happening in the room. People are being splashed with whatever is whatever the fluids are, whatever they threw in the microwave to achieve the right consistency of the sacks that are spilling out of these creations.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Rob Bottin went on to work on a single episode of Game of Thrones, and I would like to invite you both to guess.
Heads in the pike.
The George Bush, the famous George Bush head? Okay, good guess. JR?
Damn, that is a good guess. The first White Walker fight where they bring all the people back to life at the afterwards.
Sure. Yes. Both good guesses.
Ooh,
yeah. He really only contributed one iconic scene in this episode, and it's when Joffrey dies.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, it fits. The eyeballs bulging and shit. Like, oh, yeah.
Not in any other part of the episode, but they brought in a master for the screenshot they know everybody is going to be sharing.
Yeah, like it's so well done, you actually almost feel bad for Joffrey.
Yeah. I again want to reiterate how much I love body horror, and I think this is some of the best of this particular genre. One day we'll do a David Cronenberg movie, not necessarily like the History of Violence, Eastern Promises, David Cronenberg, although those do have their fair share of gore and body horror, but like your 80s era psycho gynecologist, James Woods VCR opening in his chest, just the complete or Existenz, even Existenz is so fucking weird and goopy and great. One of those movies will eventually do, and it'll give the thing a run for the money as far as the body horror goes, but it's really The Thing and David Cronenberg in competition for just the grossest, grimiest, fluidiest. I just watch these movies with giant smiles on my face. I don't know what's wrong with me. I didn't dissect enough stuff in college or high school. I don't know. I just love this shit.
I enjoy the body horror stuff too. It's fine with me. So you enjoy that? That puts a smile on your face. I imagine the opening scene. Past credits, not the spaceship flying.
Yes, we argued about that before we started recording.
The opening scene where they're trying to shoot the dog was a disappointment to you.
Because they missed.
How pissed?
It's a disappointment for humanity.
Scale
I mean,
of 1 to 10, how mad were you that they missed the dog before you knew it was an alien? I just assume you want to see dog death right away.
Of course. I often think about that scene from Watchmen when I need a pick-me-up of the dog being placed in the incinerator. Delightful. Okay. And there's no. This is a great movie. I want the movie to happen. So no, I don't want the dog to be shot. Would it have been? Okay. And I'm repaid by that patience by seeing all those dogs melted into a giant puddle.
Were you the first time you watched? Were you happier? Did it bring more? I know they're missing, so you're probably sad about that. But did it make you happier that they're throwing explosives from a helicopter at the dog?
I mean, who doesn't like dropping bombs out of helicopters haphazardly? Like Norwegian scientists thinking, this is totally going to work. I'm going to drop a bomb on a dog from a helicopter. And how great is it that they are indeed revealed to be scientists and archaeologists? Yeah. They blow themselves up on accident. The planet is at stake. They understand what's at stake, and they blow themselves up.
Fantastic.
That's the end of their movie, and that's what the 2011 version of this movie is about. Like everything that's happening at the Norwegian or whatever Scandinavian nationality they are, whatever's happening at that plant or at that site.
So wait, what's happening in the like 1950 version of The Thing?
I think it's a straightforward remake. I think the 1982 thing is a straightforward remake. With its own particular John Carpenter flavor of the original 1950s or whatever, whenever that came out version.
Okay.
I think.
I mean, I was very pissed off that they were missing the dog. I was like, how many goddamn shots can you take and not hit? It's not like this dog was like fucking bobbing and weaving and shit.
Yeah,
like
not he doing was just serpentine.
Yeah. He's literally running running straight. and getting stuck in, like, getting his feet stuck, and this guy can't even fucking shoot this dog.
Yeah, it's not the smartest alien conglomeration at that moment. I feel like it eventually gained some intelligence, but yeah, that they could have got it.
All right, you've been playing a lot of Halo with my kid. Who's a worse shot, the Norwegian or my kid in Halo?
I'm sure Jeff's blown himself up once or twice.
Oh, yeah.
We've all blown ourselves up in Halo once or twice.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's walked off the cliff multiple times. Like, I thought I could just jump down it.
And I don't play Halo with Jeff. I'm babysitting for Shane's larger child on Mondays. I tell him that Halo is for, that's something that you and your dad want to play. Like, you're a married couple and you want to save episodes of Mad Men or whatever when you can watch them together. We play Skyrim.
We're going to do a little parent, you guys give me some parenting advice here. So, Jeff, I told him, he's like, you're obviously the best player ever at Halo, right, Dad? I'm like, no, there's a lot of dorks who are way better than I am. And he's like, well, who's the best dork? And I said, I think it's probably Todd E. Or T.E. Bright.
Sure. Just to be clear.
And he asked me, he said, I just want to grow up and be better than Todd at this game.
It's important to have goals.
How do you respond that? How do you respond to that as a parent? Like,
I think you jump out your window. Like, your kid is aiming low.
Yeah.
Not even in like the most recent Halo game either. No, like an obsolete Halo game that I assume no one plays anymore on the last generation of systems.
But it's actually still supported online. I played some.
Is it really?
The other day, yeah.
Okay. I mean, if the guy is good enough at shoot 'em ups, he could be worth millions and millions.
That is true, I guess. Yeah, that's true. Do you want to raise an esports kid, though?
I was about to say, do you want to live with a PewDiePie? Is the real question.
Do you want to have wrist braces lying around your house everywhere?
I was like, dude, you can't just video games all day. He's like, why not? I'm like, well, everyone who does that just is sad and angry. Was I right to tell him that? Because I feel like it's accurate, though. Like,
you got to strike the right balance, no question.
Aren't all these e-guys like racist and misogynist?
Eventually, it is revealed that way, yes. Yeah. I can't speak for the South Koreans. That's a large contingent, but maybe they hate Japan. They probably do, actually.
And maybe I'm like, also reacting because he's got really great hand-eye coordination for his age.
So like,
if he was like a dork and sucked at like sports, or was like uninterested, like Daria uninterested in sports, would I be so upset? I'm like, you know what? It's actually, my baby's good at this.
I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand. Like, kids on those travel teams have to do something when they're in the hotels.
Yeah.
I assume one of them brings their Xbox or whatever, and they just all pile in the hotel room and play all night.
And there's the one kid who gets arrested his freshman year of college and brings the porn.
Yeah. I've read the articles.
Yeah.
So that's Jeff's characterization as his life goes on. How about the characterization of the 12 cast members? This is a short movie for as many characters as are in it. Did you guys feel that you knew enough or anything at all, really, about these guys?
I felt like I knew enough for about most of them. I mean, it's hard to get through 12 people.
Sure.
But for the most part, I think you got a good characterization of, what, 8 of them? 9 of them?
Yes. I generally agree with that. I think I don't necessarily need to know what I don't remember any other names. What the guy with the glasses necessarily?
Fuchs.
Sure. Yeah, Fuchs. He's the one that kills himself, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't necessarily need to know about like his home life or whatever, but I think for a handful of characters, there are like split second crystallized perfect moments of characterization that tell me enough or that are clear enough about those characters to where I don't really need any more. Like the way that Keith David butts heads with Kurt Russell's character tells me, and just the way that Keith David looks tells me everything I need to know about who that guy is and what his job is, even though if I've seen this movie 3 times and I can't tell you exactly what his job is at the place.
He's the angry black bald dude. That's his job.
But I wouldn't even say angry, just like I should be in charge. I don't know, this guy thinks he's a strong leader, but I'm radiating that kind of charisma. I should be in charge. We should do what I say. And the guy whose chest eventually turns into a toothed mouth, he's like the second in command. And someone asked him after the guy who's first in command, like, could possibly be infected. like, okay, you're up next. And he's like, no, I'm not doing that. I know everything I need to know about that guy just from his refusal to lead the team after he's been offered it. Enough. I've got enough characterization for that guy. So it's not perfect. I don't know that there needed to be 12 guys necessarily, but
yeah, I completely agree with there being too many people. That at one point it was just like, let's just kill some people, and they just shot a dude and killed the doc. Like, okay.
Do you think it's better or worse than the characterization they do in Predator, the first one? Where, like, the one guy has a lot of muscles.
They're relying a lot on, like, the racial characterization in
Predator. Yeah, like, you knew a lot about that guy because his wife's vagina was huge. And then the other guy with a lot of muscles, you're like, this guy's a good tracker. He must be Native American or something.
Yeah. I've seen the first. I've seen the second half of that.
A lot of muscles, but he was
the other guy with a lot of muscles, like all of them.
The final guy with a lot of muscles was Arnold Schwarzenegger. So you learned a lot.
You're leaving out like Jesse Ventura and Bill Duke.
Oh yeah,
who are also
sure had a lot of muscles.
The other people with big muscles. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen the second half of that movie probably a dozen times, and the first half once or twice probably.
Yeah.
So like all the banter or whatever between them. I don't know. I don't remember any of it. I remember the mud and Carl Weathers' arm coming off. That's pretty much all I've got from the Predator. But it was a great movie. I'm not
going to village. That's it. Yeah.
Okay.
And they wipe all the whole village out because which you could tell is emotional for Jesse Ventura's character because he got to really use his gun.
I don't know. Maybe there's like a joke about how hard their dicks are. I don't know. That's like a super gay movie, I assume. The first part of it anyways. Like everybody knows about the handshake, of course. Yeah. And I don't think it's an accident that it's Mac's favorite movie and Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah. It's anyways.
I did just watch Top Gun recently and oh my god, you want to talk about super gay?
I saw 7 weeks ago. It was a post on Twitter. I just saw it today.
So super gay.
Yeah.
Super gay.
Yeah. anyway, so if anyone says that this movie has bad characterization, they're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it's a negative that there's no homoerotic subtext in the thing, but I don't know. That was in the air in the 80s. Yeah. Like clearly a lot of action movies wanted to be about that, but couldn't quite bring themselves to just fully commit. I don't know what was happening between cuts necessarily, but like on camera, they couldn't commit.
Like, this is I don't know, Tom Cruise movie. I guess they're kind of oiled up and walking around shirtless in Antarctica.
So many buns shots in Top Gun. It's ridiculous. we did not, sadly, get a buns shot of Wilford Brimley. This is his first major role. This is also Keith David's first major role. Wilford Brimley, like, he just died. Like, his most famous stuff is...
Diabetes.
Exactly, yeah. I can think of, like, one other movie that he was in, and he showed up in, like, Chuck Norris, the Walker, Texas Ranger. And I only know that. I don't know that because I'm a dedicated follower of Walker, Texas Ranger.
Was it Cocoon huge, though?
I think it was,
huge, yeah.
But I feel like he could have been any random grandpa in any movie that needed it. And like Keith David, he's going to be in They Live, another John Carpenter movie a few years later with Rowdy Roddy Piper. But I feel like he didn't have the career that he maybe should have. Because like this is just as much as with Kurt Russell, this is a pretty early part of his career. And I wouldn't say this was like a breakout role either because this was not a successful movie. But like Keith David is... star.
If this movie comes out today, I think he gets more traction, right?
You can't make
so, yeah.
Keith David was the voice of one of the main gargoyles in the Gargoyles TV.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I saw some other voiceover work too.
How could he not?
Yeah.
What do you mean some other voiceover work? He was the bad guy in The Princess and the Frog, which is like easily.
Oh, he's the bad guy in The Princess and the Frog?
You've never seen The Princess and the Frog.
100%. I have a child, and we have Disney Plus in this house.
All right, fair enough.
I've seen it twice in the past month, actually. Jeff loves it. I was wondering.
Really? I've never looked up
who did that voice, and I actually commented, like, this is, I said something to Blair, like, this is a great, I love this characterization. This,
Keith David, it's perfect.
That's like, awesome.
He does it perfectly.
In my head, he's always Big Tim from Requiem, so.
From where?
Requiem of a Dream.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. That was in my head also.
Is Big Tim? I think it's Big Tim.
Should have had a... It's not that he's had a bad career by any means. Like, he does work a lot. But star-making role, I think. And he survives. he survives to the end, and to the thing's great credit, there are two black guys in the cast, and neither of them were the first to die. I think they're like the fourth, and the other one doesn't. So good on you.
Yeah. Well, no.
Good
on you. John Carpenter. Yeah.
It goes. Does he go into the to go get?
He Will is. Yes, he's the last. The Skates. I think his name might be Skates. I don't remember.
Yeah. He just disappears.
Yeah. He. So he's the last to die.
Yeah. Him. Then Wilford Brimley. Then the other two.
Like, Wilford Brimley, I guess, technically died. That's whenever true. He was infected.
That's true.
And when that is unclear, I think brilliant.
Oh, but, I guess, yeah. So when does Wilford Brimley end? And when does
I don't know. Begins? I have no idea.
All right. It's like the...
I would need to really watch the movie real close to figure it out. Because I think he's him when he gets into the cabin, and when he's like locked in the cabin initially. Yeah. And then at some point, he is infected. Like somebody leaves to go infect him.
Is that a Thaddeus Ship situation?
Oh, the... I think I had that in my... review.
Oh.
If I didn't have it, I would still be thinking of it. Like, is it Thaddeus or is it?
I used to say Pliny. I was wrong. I think it's Thaddeus. I don't know.
Some Greek metaphor about at what point, if you've done extensive repairs on a ship, if you replace all the wood, is it still the same ship?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
There's definitely some of that in this movie.
Then people are like, no. It's the crew, and they're like, okay, you replace the crew, and you're like, shit.
You could also, I mean, that goes along right with teleportation, the Star Trek way.
Yeah.
Like, that's are true. You actually teleporting yourself, or just destroying yourself and creating a new version?
Second to last thing about the thing, success or failure of the ending, not the ending, which is great, like the ending of like Keith David and Kurt Russell sitting in the cold. Perfect ending. Excellent. Great ending. Everything that happens before that ending really feels like a rush. Like the movie needed 10 more minutes or so. Maybe the rush is just because the thing realizes that there are now more of me than there are not of me, so I don't have to hide anymore. I can just go for it. But it seems cornier than the rest of the movie is. Like it turns into like a big pillar of biomatter.
Yeah.
And then Kurt Russell has a kiss-off line that wasn't the case. Like the movie wasn't a Schwarzenegger vehicle for one-liners up until that very last moment, and it's not even a good kiss-off line. It's like "and fuck you too."
I don't remember it.
It's "and fuck you too."
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then he throws the dynamite stick. They never show said dynamite stick going anywhere. It leaves the scene. Then they cut to the giant blob of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just starts blowing up, and you're like, wait, did like the like dog thing coming out of the chest like catch it because it intrinsically wants to play fetch or something? Like, what's happening? Yeah.
That part of the remade ship persisted. Yeah, the part of a dog that wants to catch.
Yeah.
It's stronger than an alien life form that consumes everything.
Yeah, I was doing this at work, and I looked up, and then I looked down, like, okay. Watching, and I'm like, what did I miss? I had to rewind it. I'm like,
yeah,
I didn't miss anything. It was just kind of his hat. It was like, boom.
Okay. Just the ending of Skates himself, as we earlier mentioned. Like he wanders off for an unclear reason. He should not be wandering off. So whether or not the character survived till the end, he still died stupidly. And then the final version of the thing, comes out of the floor and. Yeah, it seems haphazard and slapped together in a way that the rest of the movie very much is not.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe there's an extended version somewhere that solves those problems, but the movie is what the movie is, and it very much seems out of character, those like 4 or 5 minutes. Maybe they were running out of money, who knows. Morricone score, scale of 1 to 5?
I'm at like 2 here.
Really?
I do not care for the synth. And I'm a synth guy.
He's not a synth guy. Yeah. So maybe he was out of his element, perhaps.
I read a little bit. It seemed pretty chaotic. I don't think he was very... It's not that he wasn't very happy, but he's just like, yeah, Carpenter just did what he wanted to do with it. He just gave him like 20 minutes to use, and Carpenter recut a lot of it, I think.
Okay.
So.
And I think he often makes his own scores, John Carpenter. I could be wrong about that. JR?
I mean, I didn't really enjoy it that much either. I'll give it a 3.5.
A lot of times, especially with Morricone, the scores just come down to what's the handful and note takeaway.
Yeah.
And here it's the heartbeat that just repeats over and over and over again. And I was all about that. So I'm pretty high on the score.
And this is on a scale for Morricone. I'm not
sure.
It's good. And there's a reason I put my headphones in instead of just listening to my phone. So
I'm probably like a 3.5 to 4. So yeah, not his best work, but I think real strong. But yeah, that's just based on the motif, the heartbeat motif. Another round of the movie game coming right up. The random generator, generator number 44, Gangs of New York. I'm going to start with Cameron Diaz.
I'll go with The Mask.
Jim Carrey. Just like
happy with himself.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Movie I've never seen. Shit, John. God damn it.
Clock's ticking, you know, not messing around.
Kate Winslet.
There you go.
Titanic.
Jared's Disdain.
Billy Zane.
Zoolander.
Yeah, that's all I had.
Yes, I had the Phantom. I wouldn't have known anyone else in the Phantom.
No, neither would I.
Will Ferrell.
Blades of Glory.
I cannot think of Napoleon Dynamite's fucking name. John Heder.
There you go.
Napoleon Dynamite.
I'm in trouble. I got nothing. I'm out. Shane.
There is on Napoleon Dynamite. There is fuck. What's her name?
Yeah, I'm thinking. I was thinking of the girl. I can't.
But wouldn't be able to name is. Another movie she said. Fuck.
Napoleon Dynamite. Now, JR. 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 If you can't name someone from Napoleon Dynamite, Shane wins.
He can. He knows the guy. Because JR, back to you, man. Challenge it.
JR?
Shit, I can't.
All right, we got a three. No, Shane wins. Yeah, Shane won.
Wow. All right.
Well, how did Shane win?
Hmm?
Shane win. I said Napoleon Dynamite.
But you gotta be able to say someone else who's in the movie.
Yes, if it were to get around to you, you would need to be able to complete the loop to win.
So would we not need to? Oh God damn it! I know someone in this shit too. God damn it! And of course,
I can't think of the girl's name. She had the map on her in Waterworld.
There's also Jamie Lynn Spears, right?
I don't know who that is.
Diesel Vader is in it.
Okay. We'll give it to JR. That all sounds fine.
Okay.
All right. Our final movie is The Untouchables, another 80s movie directed by Brian De Palma. This is 1987. Sean Connery won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for this movie. In contrast to The Thing, this was tremendously successful. One of the most successful movies of that year. Still pretty well received based on the people I follow on Letterboxd. I don't really get that. What did you guys think of The Untouchables?
Would you guys rather watch this movie again or me tell you about my simulation baseball team?
Oh, this movie.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
Oh, no.
Simulation baseball all day, every day before I watch this movie ever again.
Are we negative on The Untouchables or are we just like, that was a movie that existed?
That was a movie that existed. Yeah, that's maybe. Maybe on the lower end of that was a movie that existed.
I don't even think it was bad. It was just so underwhelming from what it has a reputation of.
It's just it's a pure cops and robbers throwback to bring Once Upon a Time in the West back to it. Like if this would work as a Western, like a 1940s, 1950s John Wayne starring Western, Cowboys versus Indians. There's just nothing to this. There's nothing to this movie. It looks good. There are like really impressive compositions in it. Like it starts with this smash cut to an overhead of Robert De Niro playing Al Capone being shaved in a barbershop or in his hotel room, maybe. Who it doesn't matter, but there's just a lot going on in the scene, and that happens repeatedly. Like Brian De Palma knows how to make a movie look good. He of Scarface, he of Blowout, he of Carrie. He's made a lot of movies over the years. He's like a contemporary of Spielberg and George Lucas, and he was friends with all those guys in the 70s. But this movie is just not about anything.
It's 100% right. There's just nothing to this movie at its soul.
there's something, there's the threat, there would be a threat of something about like a cop who breaks all his rules to capture the ultimate bad guy, but he doesn't pay a price for any of those rules. He doesn't get any of his team, his team of four is reduced to two by the end of the movie. It's not his fault. He didn't show mercy when he should have been ruthless and got somebody killed. He does eventually murder a guy who's asking for his help, but he's a terrible, evil assassin. And again, he's nothing happens. He pays no penalty. He gets the medal around his neck or the big trophy at the end. Movie over.
Yeah.
No lesson learned. And he goes home to his dead-eyed wife and their two faceless children.
Fantastic.
Fine. A movie that exists. There just really is not much to this movie at all.
It's like the pretzel sticks movies.
Here's the only thing the movie has got going for it. Is if you're a fan of overacting, it is just fucking full of it.
Yeah, this is Robert De Niro. A person who can make Travis Bickle, terrible human being Travis Bickle, if not sympathetic, at least understandable. Same with his character in Raging Bull. Al Capone here is just a guy. A guy who has a way with a baseball bat and...
not enough syphilis.
I don't know, like the press seems to like him.
Oh.
His characterization in like Boardwalk Empire in that show was miles deeper. You just got to know that character. He did the same shit more or less, but you just had so much more of a sense of who he was and why he became the media darling that he became. I don't know, he's not even clever. He doesn't give good quotes to the media that, you know, likes to hear from a crime boss. That all makes sense in the abstract, but if you didn't know anything about Al Capone in real life, you would just think this guy's just a goon who rose to the top somehow. Do you think Connery is overacting?
Yes.
Okay.
Especially when he's dying.
Oh yeah, he's yes, when he's dying, absolutely.
My God.
I remember, is it like a scene, like is it like how kids would act, how to die?
He's just choking out his last words. And it goes on for a real long time. He's got a lot of last words.
So goddamn long. Costner leans in for the last word, and he's like holding his chest. The dying guy manages to muster up enough energy to like grab the fucking coat, the petticoat that fucking Costner's got on, and then starts yelling, "We gotta take him down," or some bullshit like that. You're like,
it's the exact same death too as Delroy Lindo's character in *The Five Bloods*. And if ever a character was given to monologuing after they've been filled with three, four, five dozen bullets, it would be that character in *The Five Bloods*. But Spike Lee has the good sense to realize that, like, if a character was filled with that many bullets, they would pretty much die instantly.
Yeah.
But in *The Untouchables*, Connery takes like a full load from a Tommy gun, and in the time it takes Kevin Costner to know about it, get there, and cradle him as he's dying, yeah, he's still got enough energy to choke out a long monologue.
The picture is him and Eric he's shot for like 30 seconds, so it becomes uncomfortable. What would your dying words be if you died? If you're about to die, like tonight, like what would your dying words be? I know mine.
I don't know. Like
mine would. Mine would. I'll give you a second to think here. Mine would definitely be bury Dingo before you bury me.
Mine would be like, I don't know. We were all gonna die in 5 years or so, anyways.
Okay.
So better to get it over with now.
Kind of prophetic.
I would have liked to know the end of the story, I suppose, but whatever. Okay. It all would end the same.
Okay, JR, your dying words.
Just resignation.
Just like fuck Whitey or something like that. Who knows?
It doesn't have to be your last words. You can say that all the time.
I do. Which is why I'm assuming it would probably be my last words as well.
Fantastic.
The idea of giving Connery an Oscar for this, it's just one of those like lifetime achievement. Of all the actors that the Academy would feel like are deserving of Oscars, like Connery, of all people, I don't know, there's a lot of people without Oscars. And if you had to give him one, I don't know exactly when Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade comes out, but he's so much better in that than this.
Yeah.
I think he's great in that. And I don't think he's been great in anything ever, like Zardoz or Finding Forrester. You're the Man Now, Dog.
I'm planning on watching Zardoz this weekend while I'm going to get hammered and watch Zardoz. Like, this literally was already a plan, so I'm happy you brought that up.
I can imagine getting to that one day in the future. Season 9 of Munich Movie Club. All Zardoz all the time. The famous sequence from this movie is the stairs, the baby carriage falling down the stairs in the middle of a shootout. This is an homage to a famous scene from like one of the foundational movies from the 20s, a Soviet movie called Battleship Potemkin that features pretty much the exact same thing. Baby carriage falling down the stairs during a shootout, except the shootout is much bigger in a movie that, you know, predated The Untouchables by like 70 years. For you guys, when you see a movie that's paying homage to another movie and doing it in such a blatant way as The Untouchables is to Battleship Potemkin, are you like taken out of it? Like, I remember having a conversation with a guy who was like super into the same kind of pulpy movies that Tarantino is into. Like, the average viewer hasn't necessarily ever seen The Blonde War or The Bride Wore White or whatever the Kill Bill was based on, or the movie that Reservoir Dogs kind of wholesale rips off. But if you have seen it, it all becomes much, much less impressive. It's kind of where I am with The Untouchables. I don't know if you guys feel the same way.
I don't know that, so.
No, right, fair.
I haven't seen the movie, but I am well aware of the Steps of Odessa scene or whatever.
Yes, and that's it. Yes.
So it's like, it added nothing. That's what my problem.
It's a ripoff for ripoff's sake.
Yeah, you're just like, you know what would be cool if we threw the Steps of Odessa in here at Grand Central Station or whatever the fuck the place is called. And someone was like, yeah, man, that would be cool. Like, all the people that are still alive that have seen that movie or the, you know, the fucking movie heads are going to love that. And then all the movie heads watch it and they're like, this is fucking dumb. Like, why did you do this? There was no reason. That's my problem with it. It just was there just to be there.
It would be more appropriate in like The Naked Gun at this time. Like, if The Naked Gun wanted to do that, that's funny. That's hilarious. But it's just it's just here because De Palma likes Battleship Potemkin. I can't think of any other reason why it would be here. To show that Elliot Ness is a good dude for saving the baby. What else was he going to do? Like, it's a better movie if he doesn't save the baby, honestly.
I don't know if you watch Perry Mason. You're going to like the first episode.
There's a dead baby in Perry Mason? Fire it up! Almost as good as a dog in an incinerator. A character that could have used, if not an incinerator, then like a some kind of body laser is Andy Garcia, who I think this is one of his first roles, and he hasn't like run into a publicist yet who is like, you should trim your back hair so it's not coming out of your collar.
I think that's just a thing.
I guess. It's just very noticeable. It's one of the most noticeable things about his character is how hairy he is.
I was just watching the Chuck Norris fight scene from Enter the Dragon, and his
chest hair.
Oh, he's got back hair too. Jeff's like, why does that man have back hair, Daddy? It's like, eat something.
Morricone.
You're white too, just wait.
Morricone score, scale of 1 to 5. This is middle of the pack. It's a solid 3.
I remember nothing of it, so.
Fair.
I'm going to give this a 1 because it was over the top.
Yeah, I'm going down to 2. You're right. There's like the credits song, which is pretty, or the credits whatever, which is pretty memorable. It's like a hard driving march song, but everything, it's just the poison that is the home life scenes. He scores it like it's a soap opera. Those scenes are so terrible, and it's not like he got a shitty actress to play Elliot Ness's wife. He got Patricia Clarkson, who was great. It's probably great then, but all she is just, if you've seen South Park and the cop wife character and that has shown up like 3 or 4 times, and that it's essentially just that, just supportive cop wife. Go back out there and get them and You'll have, when I'll maintain your perfect home life here and we love each other, blah, blah, fucking blah. It couldn't be more boring. And it's scored as boring as that. So yes, two on the Morricone scale.
I've got a question.
Yes.
What's the like time frame this happens in? This could have been like 6 months or it could have been 2 days. I literally have no fucking idea.
Yeah, I got nothing. I can't help you there.
Yeah.
I would believe a week and I would believe like 3 months.
Yeah, I just have no idea how long these people were together.
Final version of the movie game. The random number generator kicks up 2,813, which is the last station. That's a movie about Leo Tolstoy, starring Helen Mirren. Shane, Helen Mirren?
Helen Mirren is in internet browsers, famous for being nude.
And who doesn't love that?
I have no idea. I don't know a single fucking movie she's in.
Shane's out on the first go. JR.
Red,
yes. Bruce Willis.
Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Jeremy Irons.
Lion King.
Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Jungle to Jungle.
I don't think that's right. I think you're thinking of Tim Allen, who played Jonathan Taylor Thomas's dad in Home Improvement.
I thought they were both in the movie.
I think he's got a different. It's some. I don't. We're gonna check on that. I'm pretty sure he is not in that. I would have said Man of the House with Ted Danson.
Yeah.
Jungle to Jungle. Now that's not Jonathan Taylor Thomas. That is some other kid wandering around.
Some other white kid. My bad.
Solid guess. All right. 2-1. I win this round.
Yeah.
I win this month.
We'll
revisit.
I got a little gimmick for us as well.
Sure.
So let's take these three movies. You have to...
To refresh, Rush Hour 2, The Last Station.
No. Sorry. The three movies we watched.
Okay.
So okay. You have to spend one wild, inappropriate night in Vegas with one. You get to go on vacation for a week with one, and one has to be your roommate for a year and a half. I think.
What was the middle thing?
A week-long vacation.
I think roommate, The Untouchables, because it's boring, and it would just melt into the scenery.
Yep.
I think, and they would certainly be no fun in Vegas. Elliot Ness, come on. Which part am I taking? Am I taking Al Capone to Vegas? Then Al Capone to Vegas. If I'm taking Elliot Ness there, we're gonna play penny slots.
You don't want to take this version of Al Capone to Vegas.
No, we're gonna play penny slots. He's gonna order a soda.
This version.
Not a vodka soda. He's gonna order a soda.
This version of Al Capone in this movie is hitting on 17.
Well, and yeah, what are you gonna do? You're not gonna say anything. Yeah, he's gonna beat you to death.
Yeah.
Week long vacation. Well, Once Upon a Time in the West. Mm-hmm. Because. It would go by very quickly. So much of it would be spent in glances and looks. And The Thing is a tight, compact action romp that takes place over like 12 hours, if that. So yeah, I think that's the one you go to Vegas with.
Yeah, JR.
I'm going to Vegas with The Thing.
Yeah, I just like the unpredictableness.
The wild shit that happens out of nowhere.
Some disgusting stuff's going to happen to your body, but it's over.
Who couldn't use more tentacles while they're playing blackjack? You can play more hands.
Yeah, I think that from what it sounds like.
And if you are the actual thing, why wouldn't you want to go to a global hub where you can infect as many people as possible? Yeah.
I think what you say about the vacation, like, I just can imagine going on vacation with Once Upon a Time in the West. Like, what did you do on vacation? Sat in a hotel room and stared at each other.
It sounds pretty relaxing, to be honest. Yeah,
great.
Yeah. A lot of new developments here at the Media Comedy Club.
Gimmicks.
We'll be back next month. The three movies we're watching, 2020 comedies, all of which were depressingly released online. The first one, An American Pickle, was released on HBO, starring Seth Rogen. Second up is Palm Springs, starring Andy Samberg and the mother from How I Met Your Mother. I can't remember what her name is. That's on Hulu, and the third is Eurovision with a typical Will Ferrell subtitle that I don't know off the top of my head. That's on Netflix. In the meantime, you can check out the reviews for these previous three movies and so many others at MediaComovie.club. We also recently posted reviews of Contagion and Wuthering Heights from 2012. And what else? And I just posted a review of The Invisible Man from this year. That was very good. Probably available to rent on your various streaming services these days. Go deep into our archives. When you're looking for those Deadwood reviews from 2016, what else were we talking about back then?
Nothing.
All kinds of other stuff. Who knows?
Great for dinner.
Headhunters.
Headhunters, yeah. Another solid flick.
Yeah, randomly good movie. Lots of poop.
There was lots of poop in that movie. Check us out elsewhere on the internet, on Facebook at Munich Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Munich Movie Club. We're also on Instagram under Munich Movie Club. And that'll do us for this month. Thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Have a good night.